Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. I'm here with Dick Nesbitt. I have just read through his book, Mindware, Tools for Smart Thinking. It's a fantastic book. I only realized that I had read a textbook after I had finished it. It's one of these books that's a fantastic read. It's super interesting. The way he thinks is interesting. What I learned from it is interesting. And after I had finished it, I realized, oh my God, I've had this survey course on thinking and on my mind. You know, there's survey courses on history. This is a survey course on your mind. And I'm really, I feel fortunate to have Dick with us. He's a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan. He's one of the world's most respected psychologists. He's received awards for distinguished scientific contributions and a nice guy as well, which is a very important part of anybody who's on the show. Dick, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So my first question is, why did you write this book?
Well, I've been studying reasoning for my whole career, and I, at some point, got interested in the errors that we make, because that's a good way to find out how a system works, is to find out what errors it makes. And at some point, I began to realize, you know, some of these errors are really avoidable, some more than others, as it turns out. So, I try my hand at writing a few things. And it looked good, so I decided to make a book of it.
And so is that the big idea of the book, that there are some of these mistakes that we make there that are avoidable, and let's figure out how to avoid them?
Exactly.
You know, one of the things that I really noticed as I read the book is my own sense that I think I'm in control of my decisions. And the more I read, the more I came to believe that there are so many forces that we don't even recognize that have power over us. And, you know, your book seems in some ways to be giving back free will, right? That in some ways, if we can master what's getting in our way, those errors, we might have free will. What are some of the key elements in your life, or that you've noticed, or you've sort of seen that really make that difference in terms of giving us back our free will, that can really release us from the trappings that it kind of imprison our decision making?
Well, in a way, I try to make an end run around these things. If I know that I'm going to be swayed by some trivial thing, like whether I'm talking to somebody on a wharf and therefore things seem fishy to me, or if I'm interviewing somebody and over a cup of coffee and he seems very warm to me, so maybe try iced tea and see if he still seems like such a warm person.
Now, Dick, is that really a thing? Like, if you're talking to someone on a wharf, they may actually seem a little fishy, and over a hot cup of coffee, they might seem warm?
I take it for granted it's true. And if it's not, the general point is true, which is that we're so readily pushed around by trivial seeming things that we don't even notice consciously. And it's scary when you begin to realize this. On the other hand, since it's true, we may as well make the best of things. And it often means just encountering people or objects in as many settings as possible, so that these kinds of flotsam and jetsam that we don't want to be influenced by sort of cancels out. It's a good idea to do that in any case, because we tend to underestimate exactly how much evidence we need for our beliefs. So looking at things in different contexts gives us different orientations, which is helpful. It helps to cancel out unwanted, trivial kinds of influences that actually do have an impact on the way we think.
What are some other kinds of influences that you've seen that seem to really crop up more often than not, where we might not even notice them?
Well, one of the most important, and this won't surprise you because you know that I'm a social psychologist, is how susceptible we are to social influence and how little we see it. And I sort of make a joke in the book about all of these things that I've discovered on my own and then found out, everybody else discovered that too. I mean, so I took up cross-country skiing and then was surprised to find out my friends had taken up cross-country skiing. I bought a Saab automobile and, My friends bought a lot of them bought Saab automobiles.
I have to say that that my wife and I experienced that same thing. We, when our first child came 13 years ago, we decided that we would name her Isabel, which was a very unusual name for girls. And then a few years later, our next girl came and we named her Sophia, which we thought, oh, you know, my mother's French and it's a little French, and that's also very unusual. And it wasn't but 4 or 5 years later when we looked back and the most popular names in America were Isabel first and Sophia second.
Really? Well, that...
Yeah, and it's... We had no idea.
I don't know. That's in the drinking water.
Right,
I don't know.
Right. We had no idea. It's not like people were talking about it, but somehow the culture pervades our thinking. How does that work? Why is that? Why did we end up naming our kids like that?
Honestly, this one is a great example for one. I have no idea how that works. For the rest of it, I mean, you know, I see a Saab and I see a distinguished looking guy getting into the Saab and, you know, begin to think of myself as maybe a Saab owner and find out a little bit about it. There's a great New Yorker cartoon. A guy is standing talking on his cell phone. He's saying, I don't know why. I just felt like calling. And he's surrounded by people who are on their cell phones. So we're picking up this stuff, you know, from the atmosphere. The name thing is really weird because, of course, it's true. I named my daughter Sarah, and every fifth kid in the nursery school was named Sarah. That we're picking up social influence with our somehow.
So let me ask you a question about leadership and how leaders kind of use or maybe abuse, but I don't even know that that's possible or that's the right way to think about it, this kind of psychology. You know, as leaders, here's my question. Are we better educating people about the way they make decisions and the kinds of things that might infiltrate their decision-making? Or are we better to structure environments that engineer their choices so that they make the kinds of choices that we know will move the organization forward?
Well, I certainly lean toward the second of those. And one of the things that I talk about the most in the book is the fundamental attribution error. That is the sense that we've learned a lot about somebody from a small amount of information, and now we think we know what their traits are across the boards. This makes it very dangerous for us to interview people because we think that we've picked up much more about them than we really have. The half-hour interview, as it's usually conducted informally, is virtually worthless as a predictor of behavior in almost any role, student, doctor, employee in a business corporation, and so on. So there are ways that we can protect ourselves from that. We can structure the interview. And if you structure an interview, you ask everybody the same questions, you really can get a fairly decent prediction about performance. And someone just told me recently about a four-question interview. And I don't remember all the questions, but the first one struck me as a very good idea, and that is, what are your goals in life? What do you want from a job? And you know, it was clear to me from that question, a lot of people, they have a calling. They must have a calling. That's the kind of person I want to hire. Says, well, this is what I need to do with my life. Oh, okay, now we're cooking with gas. Other people who are, you know, start talking about, you know, a job that's convenient and comfortable and so on, you know, that's, I've lost interest. So that would be, for me, a very good first question to begin with. But there are psychologists who can help you with a structured interview, which will protect you from the often very mistaken judgments that we make from the informal interview.
One of the first articles I ever wrote for Harvard maybe 5 or 6 years ago was about the number one interview question you should always ask. And that question was, what do you do in your spare time? And my thought was that if I understand what you do in your spare time and I can get you to do that for me and my organization, then I've made a really good choice, because whatever you do in your spare time, you really love doing anyway. And now you'll do it professionally for me and it'll work. Would that be a good interview question?
Sounds like a good one to me.
So let me ask you a question. If it's true that interviews are mostly worthless, which it sounds like it is, how do organizations or how do leaders assess cultural fit? That's one of the challenges is, you know, you see someone who's been incredibly successful in one company and then they join another company and they fail miserably. And it's not because they don't have the skill. And as you mentioned in your book, which I believe in 100%, past performance predicts future performance, but in many cases it doesn't when you change cultural environments or settings. So how do you figure out if a person's going to really fit well in that particular cultural setting?
Well, it's a great question. I don't have a great answer for that. That's for sure. You can often find out about a person how they relate to other people. You can ask questions that can reveal that. You can ask questions, I suppose, about a person's previous employment and ask how he functioned in those roles and where he was comfortable and where he was not comfortable. But frankly, these are just my guesses, and I don't really know that there's much that you can do to find out. I mean, there can be structural problems. Malcolm Gladwell writes about the fact that college football performance is such a poor predictor of professional football performance, and it's because it's a different game. Now, how you make the adjustment there, you know, I know how good he was in college. How do I adjust to professional football? And Gladwell says, you know, there isn't any obvious way to do that. Probably the best answer to your question is hire a million employees and see which one works out.
Yeah. And what he talks about is what you have to just do is put a million football players on the field. You'll find out who's really great.
Well, you know, that works, come to think of it, for getting graduate students. I mean, there are certain feeder schools that we have. The University of Waterloo, I mean, somehow the people we get from there seem to work. Stanford undergraduates, they work. Ivy League, not so much.
which works at the analyst level, but maybe not in the leadership level. But I think your suggestion, which is to understand in detail what environment they succeeded in the past and then compare that to your environment, would be really useful. You know, if you have success hiring from one company, you might be better off hiring multiple people from that company, because it would give you an indication that people over there succeed over here.
Yeah, I certainly think that. And it, as I was writing the book, it became clearer and clearer to me that we can do experiments on ourselves. And there can be quite, even though we're an N of one, you can get a pretty good inference because you have a before after effect. You get rid of a lot of error by the fact that it's just you you're looking at and you are a constant. But you have to be systematic about changes. So am I going to be better off drinking coffee or not? Does coffee make me more effective at work, or does it make me jittery and irritable? And I'm only going to find that out if I do an actual experiment, which means basically flipping a coin when I come into the kitchen in the morning, coffee or no coffee. And then be systematic about the observations. Was I jittery today? Yes, no, a lot, not much. And same thing with reflux at night. Is it the alcohol that's doing it? Is it eating too close to bedtime, etc.? You've got to be systematic about recording things and ideally creating the proper experimental test by doing a random choice of condition.
And why the flipping the coin part?
Well, otherwise, if I get up, I'll have coffee this morning because my spouse made it for me. Or I have coffee this morning because I'm absent-minded. I just go ahead and make it as usual. Or I don't have coffee because I don't think to do it. Or I have coffee because I think I need to be very alert today. So all of these kinds of things are confounded variables. I don't know whether I'm being very alert today because of the coffee or because I know I have to be alert today. And among the things I did to make sure I'll be alert is to have a cup of coffee. It's just, it gets rid of this kind of noise, and you get down to just the coffee or not coffee plus my...
And my spouse offered it to me, and so I feel really good about the fact that she thought of me, and so now I feel good. And it's not necessarily the coffee, it's the fact that, you know, my wife was thoughtful. One question about meditation. I'm curious as to what you think about, you know, the ability of meditation to see how these things play into our mind. So if meditation is watching the mind to some degree, and these are all tricks that the mind plays, have you found that it's useful in terms of kind of uncovering some of these contextual variables that control our thoughts?
I haven't. Actually, your question seems to presume that I'm meditating. And like everybody else I know, I am now meditating. Just like I'm no longer playing tennis and I no longer drink after dinner drinks. So my friends are doing it, so I'm doing it. But I don't honestly know what I've learned from it. I really don't.
Well, you know, thank you. Thank you. And actually, one of the things that I really like about that answer is that I have a real takeaway from this book. And my takeaway is twofold, is to be curious and to be humble. That you know, the humility that comes from realizing that I'm not in control of everything, and the curiosity that comes with thinking about, you know, why am I making that choice? And is that the right choice? And what else might be influencing me? So the sort of my takeaways from this book is really in four words is be curious, be humble. And I really so appreciate you coming on the show. And I loved both speaking with you. I loved reading your book. As I said, you tricked me into reading a textbook, and you tricked me that I only figured that out at the end when I realized how much I had actually learned and what a survey it was. The book, Mindware, Tools for Smart Thinking by Richard Nisbett. Dick, thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it. And thank you for the time and energy you took into writing the book.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.